Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's go back to 2011 with Squidge. Let's look at the World Cup again with Squidge.
Hello and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup retrospective podcast. Very much the, I would say, the Toby Flood of rugby podcasts. As in,
what makes you say that?
People are wondering why it's happening in 2021. Nice. We are joined as I'm Robbie or Squidge or whatever you want to say, call me. And we are joined as ever by
Will Owen, some other guy.
And today's game will be England against France from the quarterfinal. And when we were at the very start of talking about this podcast, drawing up who a potential good guest might be for what games, I think literally the first person that we said would be perfect for a particular game was the man joining us today, Mr. Lee Calvert of the Blood and Mud podcast, who I can't tell you why I thought you'd be perfect for seeing England embarrass themselves against France in a quarterfinal, the Martin Johnson era, but it just felt right.
Yes, how are you doing, first of all? Thank you for the invite and the long you've come off a long run up this, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You did tell me a while ago you'd do it. So yeah, I've been able to brace myself for the fact
it's
that
it's probably coming up on a year. Right?
Something like that, I think. But you can, you know, listeners can't see me, but I imagine you must be sort of laughing and pointing at me for the next hour or so as I do my best to try and talk through this game. I had to watch it again. That's the first thing I'm upset about. So you've got all that pent up to come out. So
there was, of course, the dilemma of the fact we are talking about the World Cup Alan Brew played in, and we still asked you to do this game.
Well, yeah, that's true. That is true. You know what? Surprising players involved in this World Cup is a theme that will come up in this episode as well. I mean, I know there's lots of surprising players in the Johnson episode, but in the Johnson era even. But even I was surprised when I looked at the squads again. I go, gee, really? But we'll get onto that later on, I'm sure. But thank you, and nice to be here.
No, thank you for doing it. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. How was your experience of going back to this game 10 years on, presumably having not thought about it much in the intervening 10 years?
I will be honest, it was better than I remembered it being. In my mind, I thought it was a terrible game in that because the result was kind of terrible, I suppose, for me. But it was a better game than I remember. That's the first thing. The other thing is I had to find it on YouTube. It was in one of those 15-minute clip type scenarios off Maori TV.
Yes.
So that was, I watched the exact same one as you did.
I mean, how awful was Gavin Hastings throughout the entirety of this game as the colour commentator?
I think the worst thing about that is that he was the best of that commentary trio.
That's the other thing, yeah.
So Ben Foddon playing fullback for England.
Yes.
For starters. And what sounded like Mark Q-tip on the left wing.
This is it. This is the Pro Evo versions where they haven't got the licences.
Yeah, so, I mean, for starters, while we're here, they said that Haskell was a standout coming from the bench. They said that they're really looking forward to seeing him come on. And they said, hopefully we get to see a lot of Banahan, just because he's big, I guess. But yeah.
When Banahan did come on, they were astounded at the sheer height of him.
Yeah.
As if they'd never seen a professional rugby player before.
And they were so excited for him to get the ball. And yeah, as I say, that they were calling Mark Cueto Mark Cueto all game. Yeah. And as I'm pretty sure someone said Q-tip at some point. I mean, I'm sure he'd make a handy winger. But Mark Cueto, I thought, given what happened in the last World Cup, would be a name that you'd remember.
You'd think so. And also, I'm assuming they're just astounded to wanting Banahan to get the ball so they could wonder how slow a person takes to get up to full speed. And I'm guessing that was what they were really wondering about. Although, again, no spoilers, but I was pleasantly surprised by that. My memory probably failed me again about his performances. So anyway, so it probably wasn't as bad as I thought, although it is as bad as I thought. So we'll get into that later. Because anyway.
It's England are better than I thought they were watching it back. And I think for 5 minutes, they genuinely play quite well. And that threw me off entirely. And I did wonder if I'd clicked on the right game.
I think what I learned from watching the game really is, again, we'll get into the details. I mean, they were second best on the day by quite a distance in the score. But what I did find out watching, I was thinking, this is better than the team that got to the final 4 years ago.
Mm.
And this team's not very good in 2011. So imagine how bad that team was and got to the final in 2007. Yeah. Whenever you may go back and do that episode, but I think that was before you were born, 2007. Yeah.
By the way,
I was two.
Are you available to help us on the 2007 one? It would probably be about 4 years before we do it, but if you want to appear on an episode, then...
Toby Flood still weren't retired.
Yeah.
I can do the South Africa group game. How's about that? That'd be a fucking joy, wouldn't it, to go through
done
that
deal.
One again. When Andy Farrell had to do the kicking because everyone else was injured, and we didn't even get a kick in that game. That's how bad we were. Andy Farrell had no kick to even attempt.
Was that 36-0, that one in the end?
Yeah.
It stands out. Like a
Paul Sackey on the wing. Strong, strong times.
It's one of those things that you, as you were saying about, you look back and go, Paul Sackey has like 15 caps. That not only happened, that continued to happen.
Yeah. There were some brilliant Spider Cam pictures from that. Sorry, we're not talking about our World Cup. There's some great Spider Cam pictures from that game of Paul Sackey being stepped from above. You can see how awful his body position is as numerous people just go flying past him. Of course, he's got far more international caps than I'll ever have, but who cares?
It's important to state on this podcast that we are all shit.
Yeah, it's like, yes.
But we will, will not let us hold back from
Paul Sackey might have more international caps than me, but I'm also not Paul Sackey. So, you know, you win some, you lose some. Speaking of selections, I watched this with French commentary, which was a lot of fun. There's a wonderful moment of commentary on the French language version as France won a scrum. And the reaction was so over the top that it was just a solid scrum by France. And I will, instead of just teasing it, this is how it went. So I then, after that, looked up the exact same moment on Marry TV's coverage. So this is what you two will have heard.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
And I enjoyed the contrast.
I do think that one of the things that rugby commentary is missing nowadays is eyes. I do think we do need a bit more of that.
Yes, all just told. Except for Sean Holly, who's constantly saying
I'm going to quickly find for you my favourite piece of commentary from the Maori TV bit. I think I've got it here, so bear with me.
Back inside, and Freddie Mercury's happy. He's singing a tune. I want to break free. We'll rock you something along those lines.
He has broken free.
That's exactly what France are doing. They're rocking England.
I had a moment of thinking they'd called Freddie Michalak Freddie Mercury.
They were calling Marc Lievremont Freddie Mercury because
he has a moustache.
We talk about Marc Lievremont's tash, by the way.
Please.
Was Movember a thing in 2011, or was he actually choosing to do that for non-charity reasons?
I think he just did it. Because it was September, wasn't it?
It was October, so I really hope it wasn't November related.
He's getting a head start in.
Yeah.
Usually the final's in November, isn't it, if at any time. Mm. But it was just in a litany of baffling decisions that Marc Lievremont made, the tash was just probably the top hat that was on top of it already.
At the time, you didn't notice. It was just another one.
I'm also living for the fact that he could only think of We Will Rock You and I Want to Break Free, and then just couldn't think of any more Queen songs, so just quit while he was slightly behind, not massively. But I think the metaphor wasn't really going anywhere when he realised that the team that have just scored Want to Break Free.
I began to mention the teams.
Yes.
And I laughed when I saw the teams come up at the beginning because I noticed Toby Flood was starting in the centre.
So did Mike Tindall pull out before the game? That was it, right?
So Mike Tindall got injured in the previous game.
Right.
And it was a decision to start Toby Flood. They had other choices.
Yeah. So they picked the non-dwarf tossing centre.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Gavin Hastings on Maori TV had a lot of time for Toby Flood. Three times, I think he said he was today's man.
There was a lot of shade being thrown at Wilkinson, though, wasn't
Loads.
There? I mean,
yeah.
Every
he's
time
not today's
he kicked
man,
the ball,
Will. He needs to understand.
Every time he kicked the ball, they were sort of doing it. Oh, they need to give it to Flood. You know, Flood will bring a lot more creativity to this England back line. And then when eventually they did put Flood at 10, every single time, and this is no exaggeration, every time Flood got the ball, he just ran perfectly straight into the French midfield, and Aaronautiki was just twatting him.
Yeah, and they kept explaining that that was brilliant because he was taking it to the line and making them think. Yeah, making Aaronautiki think how easy it was to tackle Toby Flood every time he had the ball. That's how much thinking he was doing.
I think the other most surprising thing about this England team is that there is the second row of the two most forgettable England players of the last 10 years, which are Lewis Deacon and Tom Palmer.
Yeah, story, right? 2011 Six Nations. Well, in 2011, I had the blog Blood and Mud, obviously, and I didn't like Lewis Deacon. And I made it obvious that I thought he was a terrible, terrible selection for England. Then O2 got in touch with me. Because I think for about 5 minutes in 2011, I might have been an influencer for about 5 minutes. And they said, do you want to come to Twickenham to watch Italy versus England in our box and all that stuff? And I said, yeah, great. I was still drinking then. So got shit-faced on their dime, had food, all that kind of stuff. And then they said, yeah, then players come around at the end because it's hospitality to do a bit of Glenland and say hello. I was with my mate and the guy we got was Lewis Deacon. He walked in with a PR. My mate goes, Lewis, do you read the internet at all about what people say about your performances and everything? I thought, I don't fucking believe this. Because obviously, you know, I didn't rate him as an international footballer, but I did rate his ability to squash my head with one hand if he found out. Anyway, to be fair to him, he did that very deadpan Lewis Deacon thing, which he's still got now, hasn't he, when you see him on the coaching bench. He just went, no, I don't read anything like that. And that was it. Honestly, it was a terrible nomination to walk the hospitality suites, I'll be honest. But yeah, so I did experience what it was like to have a proper hospitality gig at a game. And you can understand why it goes to people's heads, because it's wonderful. Don't pay anything. You wait in hand and foot. You get a seat with foam on it. And you get to nearly get your head kicked in by Lewis Deacon at the end. So
they don't advertise that bit, do they? They don't tend to leave that on the packages. They don't say, you know, for an extra $50,000, you can get your head kicked in by Lewis Deacon.
You know what? I've just had a thought.
If you write enough, he'll do it for free.
Lee, sorry, we're going to just very, very briefly, Robbie. Just we'll stop recording this.
Oh, sorry.
Should we offer a Patreon feature where we can kick people's heads in?
I'll level with you. I'm about 4'3".
Okay, and I'm 4'4". I can work with that.
I don't think I'm very good at, like, I've met some people who are Patreons, and I've tried to kick their heads and it didn't go very well.
Okay. Are they still Patreons?
Some of them. You'd be very surprised what people are into.
Okay, so Lee, you can reconnect with us now. You can come back.
I mean, I'd be less worried if I'd said something bad about you and you two came in the room and you might find out, I'll be honest. I'm not going to throw too much shade, but...
We're also not mates with Simon Shaw.
No. Well, yeah, I mean, that's to go back to that second row point, that was the kind of, your point, Will, that was almost a talismanic pairing of just how utterly, utterly ordinary the expectations of squad selection and performance were of this entire period, really, because they were, well, just so crushingly, maybe just about competent most of the time.
Like, I got into the second half and I had to look up who was playing the second row for England because I couldn't believe they'd start Lewis Deacon in a World Cup quarterfinal.
He started all year. It was quite a settled team. They'd won the Six Nations this year, don't forget. And he'd settled on that forward pack fairly early in 2010, Johnson. He mixed the backs up quite a lot after because after 2010, that's when Dellin Armitage went. Queto stuck around, but that's when they had. That's when Flood came in. Chantaine Harpe came in.
Yeah, we're hearing here,
and so on. Really, Manu came in. Obviously, the rise of the Manu was this year. Yeah. So, Ben Fodden.
Yeah,
that was the coming thing. That Dennis Armitage was flirted, and Ben Fodden came in. Obviously.
Ben Foden flirting is very unlike him, of course.
So the point I'm trying to make is this wasn't forced upon him. No. It wasn't a rash of horrendous injuries just before the tournament or anything. This was what he thought was the best boiler house pairing in the land.
I think there's something of Lewis Deacon and Steve Warwick before him, of players that reminded Martin Johnson of himself in that they were workmanlike and they weren't necessarily talented or freaks of nature, but they just got the job done. But the thing is, Martin Johnson was really, really good. And the players he was picking in his image, he was clearly very self-deprecating in the players he was picking in his own image.
Deacon was renowned for being like hard as nails in the tight and stuff. You know, he had that going for him. But there's plenty of, you know, I played with second rowers that were hard as nails in the tight in Division 4 East in South Wales. You know, it's not a recommendation, as you say, for World Cup quarter-final appearances, generally speaking.
Yeah.
Should we look at the French team?
Yeah, I was going to suggest the exact same thing.
Yeah. Okay. So, once again, France, Marc Lièvremont, or Freddie Mercury, they might want to call him, looked at the France game against the All Blacks, where they had Morgan Power at 10 and they got battered, and the game against Tonga, where they lost, and thought, you know what we're going to do? We're going to put Morgan Power at 10 again. And it worked decently, don't get me wrong. I mean, Yashvili and Power, there is something there. But
there's this incredible thing that happens in the second half, to, you know, spoilers for a moment. But Francois Trandoute comes on, what, around like 65 minutes or something, 60-odd minutes, and plays like a fly half and kicks for the corners and actually acts and links the back line up. And again, looks like a fly half. And France clearly go, God, that worked, didn't it? Like, you know, Francois Trandoute really works as an impact sub rather than going, having a fly half works. So they then leave Paro at 10 for the next two games, assuming what happened only happened because he came off the bench.
Yeah. What I will say, though, it's almost like he wanted Parrott in the team at all costs, really. Mm. But then you couldn't ignore Yashvili, who I'd forgotten. It's good to be reminded what a decent player Yashvili was, I think.
So good, yeah.
So very good. And it's almost like, well, he has to play, but Parrott's this wonderful, I mean, he's so French, I can't drop it. I mean, he's almost like a national representation of what French rugby is, Morgan Parrott, isn't he? So he's like, I can't drop him at all.
He's a French-looking man as well. He looks so French.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it'd be like without playing without the chicken on the badge, you know? Like they just wouldn't be the same.
It's Morgan Power or it's Andre the Giant. One of them's playing 10, take your pick. So looking at the actual game, I suppose, unless were you done with your point, Lee?
Oh, yeah, completely. Yeah, I mean, I could keep going at any point if you let me go, but you better just leaving it. Yeah.
I think the other thing of note about the teams, actually,
go on.
Is England go for what is nominally a 5-2 split way before Razzy Erasmus is doing it. So, Martin Johnson, complete trendsetter of all the people playing in that 1997 Springbok Lions tour. It wasn't Razzy Erasmus who was setting this kind of precedent. It was Martin Johnson, clearly. He's clearly the best coach there. But the other thing is, you say it's a 5-2, but one of those is Matt Banahan. So really, it's a 6 Wigglesworth split.
I was going to say, I don't think Martin Johnson knew you were allowed to pick players under 18 stone on the bench.
No, except for Richard Wigglesworth, which was the one exception in all cases.
A big Gooden beats a little Gooden in Martin Johnson's mind every time. Even a slightly mediocre Biggin beats a good Littman in his mind, I think.
There's also something in the fact that you had Ben Youngs, nippy youngster, you know, just come into the team as a exciting young dynamic scrum half. And on the bench for him is the more experienced, calmer head of Richard Wigglesworth, which is still the dynamic at Leicester. You've still got Richard Wigglesworth coming off the bench.
A decade later.
Yeah. Amazing. 10 years, like that. Now that Ben Youngs has gone through, like, there's something watching Ben Youngs again in this game where, especially in the second half, he's so nippy and quick and dynamic and taking quick taps and bringing such pace to England.
He does play well, to be fair,
Yeah, he plays really well, like, especially that second half. Where there's a proper, like, you live long enough to see yourself become the villain thing to Ben Youngs in this game.
He'd come off the bench and won the game against Argentina, hadn't he?
Yes. Youngs,
that was a kind of turning point, wasn't it? And sort of bye-bye to... Danny Kerr started that game, I think, didn't he?
Okay, it was Wigglesworth.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Okay.
Don't apologize. You're glad you didn't watch that game again.
Yeah.
That's how yes.
8-4 match.
Yeah.
Only every performance in this World Cup was something to endure rather than a game to honestly. Yeah.
But like England had still somewhat underperformed against the likes of Georgia and Romania in the pool stage, and Ben Youngs for some of those games was playing by himself and looked like the only player who was doing anything decent. I was going to say that at the start of this game, it takes England about 1 minute to spread the ball wide and find Tuilagi in a load of space. At which point, it's a textbook thing of seeing Chris Ashton with his arm in the air, running a perfect support line, and you think if he gives it, Ashton is in. And Tuilagi just completely ignores him and runs into touch instead.
Is it a minute after that where It was it chips it through after that, and Yashley
Fodden,
and Yashley does the most emphatic thunder twatting of a ball into touch I've ever seen in my life. He's covered in behind and he hits it with his left peg. No, he doesn't break the advertising hoarding. He's about 4 meters from the touchline. He absolutely twats it. It's incredible. I don't think it popped the ball.
And because it was one of those where you go like, oh, that's a good option by Foden. You know, you're Ashton chasing as well and everything, and then suddenly they're back in their own half, like in Twickenham.
Yeah, for most of the rest of the half, effectively.
Yeah. There's a few great moments, you know. Ben Young is feeding the ball to Tuolangi and you think, oh, something might happen here, and it doesn't. Tuolangi doesn't pass. Then there's another point where Wilkinson looks like he's going to pass to Tuolangi and he instead passes the touchline, setting a great example for Ben Young's 8 years later.
That's sort of the turning point, isn't it? That's the... Yeah. Everything's going quite well for England, and then they have a line out 5 meters out that they lose. And tell you what, the French commentators
lost the line out after the thunder twatting kick from Yashley. Yeah. 2 minutes in, five meters out from the French line, and they fucking lost the line out.
And Morgan Parra goes like, "Oh, well,
this is the rest of your day, by the way, if you're English like me."
It's 9 a.m. This is what you got up for.
Parra challenges Yashvili and goes, I can see how hard you can kick a ball. I'm going to do the same thing, and just sends it miles into the English backfield.
I think it's the moment Wilkinson throws that ball into touch, England just go like, should we be shit now? Like, that was, honestly, we tried being good.
That was the best 10 minutes of England's campaign.
Yeah.
By far. They scored 0 points for clarity. But the best 10 minutes. It was nice to look at, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know what the year 2011 loved?
It moves like Jagger?
Yes. Bootcut jeans.
Yes.
And miss pass.
Mm.
And England fucking loved a miss pass. Brian Smith's entire attacking strategy was try and throw a miss pass in, which they did in every single situation, even if it meant bouncing the ball off Mark Coeto's head repeatedly. That seemed to happen quite a lot as well. But honestly, I think I saw two occasions where there was some shape on the back line. Other than that, it was just one big long line of players having a miss pass thrown across them for no apparent reason.
There's one point where England tries to do hands down the line and they can't even do that. They just throw it straight to Doucetois, who just kind of comes in and like joins in as the 13. He's like, Tuolangi.
There's one point where Ben Youngs takes a quick tap, goes through the French midfield and think, oh, okay, England are on for something here. And he spots Mark Coeto out wide and thinks, right, I'm going to get this to him. And instead he skips him and goes straight to Ashton. And the ball is in the air for that long that I'm pretty sure two French slugs came and tripped him up.
There's another one after Youngs makes a bit of a break where they get right up to the try line. And this is maybe the moment that made me laugh the most. No, actually, there's a few contenders.
How many times did you involuntarily laugh watching this game? Because I was up to about four, and I'm English. So you must have been just howling with laughter the whole time. There were at least two occasions where I just kept either putting my hand on my forehead or just guffawing involuntarily.
It is tragedy plus time, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible.
There were noise complaints. You know, my neighbour complained several times. It was, yeah, haven't heard since I watched the Johan Uche tribute a few days earlier. It was the last time we heard noises that loud. Though we won't explain what those were. Yeah, there's a great moment, one of my favourite moments, where Youngs does really well. They get up to the trial line, they go for a couple of phases, and then they have an overlap on the right, and instead Youngs decides to go left, where none of the players are interested. They're all kind of looking at the right, this, where there's an overlap. And so he goes to throw the miss pass to Ashton, which, you know, makes some level of sense. You know, he's the top try scorer at this World Cup. He's playing well. Yeah, exactly. He finishes everything, you know, scored those four tries against Italy in the Six Nations, top try scorer in that tournament as well. And then just Mark Coeto walks in between the ball and Ashton, and it just hits him in the arm and gets knocked forward.
It's literally... one of those things, like, you know when you walk past somebody in the street and you slightly get into their space, you go, oh, sorry, mate. It was literally like that.
And he was kind of, is that the one where he, right about the end of the first half, where he was retreating backwards in between two players? It bounces off his arm. Then the ball comes all the way right and Wilkinson goes to find, I think it's Ashton, and he throws it 3 foot over his head on the 39th minute. And he does, to be fair, he gets fingers on it, Ashton, but it flies, I don't know if it's Ashton, but whoever it was, it flies through his fingers anyway. Unbelievable.
It's one of those where he has to do the full Ash Splash takeoff to try and catch the ball, by which point he's crossing the advertising hoarding. Ash really just broke.
But yeah, so much of it. So And we haven't even talked about the drop goal yet, which
Oh, yes.
I think this is the moment.
I think this is your moment to describe this.
What have I written down here? Young's 25th minute. Phases work in the middle of the field. There's still quite a long way out. That's the first thing. So what were we thinking of? It's, what would you call it? A spiralized fart of a pass from from
that's the technical
Young's
term.
That is intended for Wilkinson, but drops both short and wide, I think. Bounces to Flood, who then has this kind of cowpat foot attempt at a drop goal, which, again, I just laughed out loud. Because, again, it's been so long since I watched it. These things are like a revelation again.
Yeah.
And he thought, he's going to try that. Oh, my word. Yeah, absolutely incredible. And it, and when you see the bit from behind the goal, as Flood kicks it, he does a kind of 360-degree spin of frustration.
Yeah.
For the second it leaves his boot.
And the crowd will fucking hate him for it as well.
Favourite thing is then Toby Flood turns the referee and complains. Like, what are you complaining about? What could you possibly be hoping happens there?
I used to play badminton quite a bit, and sometimes I'd smash the shuttlecock off the rim of my racket. And the first thing you do is look at your racket, isn't it?
Yeah.
As if there's something, you know, fundamentally wrong with the design of your racket. He just thought, do you think the ball was not regulation or something? Was he asking the ref to get his calipers out to measure the width of the ball or something?
I thought the posts were going to be 4 foot to the left and about 2 meters off the ground.
Who's marked this pitch, ref?
I thought,
apparently, I'm 50 meters away, and I thought I was inside the 22.
I thought you got points for missing the goal. that would elongate his career another 15 years.
There was another great point where I've got written in my notes. Morgan Parrott attempts a drop kick for absolutely no reason. And it's one of those great things that happened in 2011 that doesn't happen anymore, where now teams have to be prepared for a drop goal. You have to actually set up for it as though it's the right option. So it's one of those things that if you're going to go for a drop goal and you don't have the confidence to tell your teammates about it, you probably shouldn't be going for a drop goal, because they'll probably just say, no. But back in 2011, players could do that. They could just drop it onto their right foot and hope for the best.
And Morgan Parra wouldn't listen to anybody saying no to him anyway.
True.
Make absolutely no point whatsoever. And he doesn't consult with anybody about anything.
I imagine he was saying, like, no, it did land in the South Island, so it's fine.
Yeah.
If you're only 10, that doesn't consult with his backline at any time about what's going to happen next. Having said that, though, what is noticeable in the first half, second half slightly differently, but in the first half, how markedly better in every way France were.
Yeah.
Well, particularly in the back line when they got, I know in French way, but actually it's not that. They actually did have some weirdly for the Riedermont period, which was like a just exercise in chaos theory most of the time. They did actually look quite well drilled.
Yeah.
Was that just me?
I think there's probably something in the fact that it all goes to shit when Liedermann has a word with them at halftime. And all falls apart.
What did you say to them, Mark? Was it all Queen puns? Is that what the problem was? Listen, lad, you need to sail across the seven seas of Rye. Don't stop me now.
So the French coverage, just as the teams are running out for the second half, they interview Marc Liedermont, and he looks miserable. He looks like his dog just got shot. Like
In his defense, they were on the brink of tears.
Yeah. And it's just like, my French is not great, and I couldn't understand a word he was saying, because it was in French. But you did not get the vibe that they were 16-0 up at halftime in a World Cup quarterfinal at all. So I don't know if he just went in there when, I'm just gonna ruin your parties, take away, all of the Coke and fizzy drinks you've been drinking, take away, all the end-of-term stuff. But yeah, it seemed like he must have just gone in there and just ruined all of their atmosphere and vibes so that they only scored 3 points in the second half despite being completely dominant in the first.
Do you want to have a look at the tries they scored in the first half? So the first one, Parra ran quite a nice little loop sort of move around Mermoz, and then I'm pretty sure every single person in England missed a tackle on Vincent Clair.
That Ben Fodden tackle, inverted commas, on Clair, because he comes through, that was a prop. That was the one I did the involuntary laugh the most. Because how can a man turning in slow motion completely bamboozle you as an international fullback, Ben?
And the most surprised person of all is Vance Sinclair when he gets through. Yeah, it's like, oh, still... no, you should, I should have been nailed there.
Yeah.
This is a quarterfinal. Do better. Mother
of Christ, did that work? Oh, my God, there's the line. You know.
And the best thing about it is then after Ben Foden misses the tackle, Chris Ashton just comes up and inadvertently clotheslines him.
The fact that Ashton accidentally, I don't know if it's accidental, he tackles Foden instead of Vance Sinclair. So as Foden's, you know, obviously missed the tackle, but he's getting back, he could yet scrag him and stop him just before the line. Ashton then runs in, grabs him, pulls nails him, and throws him at the floor, and both of them go down, which is, that is the funniest moment of the game to me. That is the absolute highlight, is Ashton.
Honestly, you can laugh as much as you want. I lived through this. I was only 35 years old. I was already getting to a middle-aged depression problem. And I had to sit through this. You were all right. You were like, I don't know, amoebas or something at that age. But by that time, were you about four or something? But yeah, so yeah, I lived this twice.
Yeah. Old enough to be depressed still. But yeah. And, you know, there's something in looking at that, the way France played in the second half, of Wales should beat them easily next week. So yeah, that won't be a problem. You know? Particularly the scrum, you know, if Adam Jones stays on the pitch the whole time, they should have him at the scrum completely. But
the English scrum was shite.
Yeah.
For at least the first half an hour before they got them. Dan Cole was 24 at this time and looked 77.
Yeah, he looked exactly the same. There's a close-up of a
incredible.
Young Dan
I think
Cole.
He came out of the womb looking like that. Amazing.
The beard and the receding hairline and the lot.
I think the thing about Dan Cole, have you ever seen somebody where you can predict what his accent and his voice is going to be as much just looking at him? Have you ever seen somebody else with that vibe?
I don't think I've ever heard him speak, you know, in the 12 years he's been in professional rugby or thereabouts. I'm not sure I've actually heard him speak.
Firstly, well done in avoiding the thing of him and Joe Marler in the last World Cup being just, they're so wacky and bancy.
I don't even know what that is, and I hate it already just from what you've said. So,
Clive Woodward got very angry about it, which therefore makes it okay in my eyes. but there's the other thing, just on the scrum. So the other thing that's kind of typified this England team, beyond being a bag of shit, is their discipline, which is an even bigger bag of shit.
Yeah.
And like even playing Steve Walsh rules, they're being penalised. Like, even Steve Walsh is blowing... Like, Steve Walsh blows his whistle twice in the first 10 minutes and both of them are to penalise England.
I mean, it has to be said, I'm not one of those who has a go at the ref too much.
Mm.
But he just refs entirely on vibes and the moon or something, doesn't he, Steve Walsh?
Oh, he throws tarot cards down to see if there's a penalty in the ref.
I think he's got a spinning wheel, hasn't he?
Yeah.
My favourite part of England's indiscipline was Lewis Deacon giving away probably the funniest penalty of the tournament so far.
Oh.
There's a point, France have made a bit of a break, and then instead of going wide, they think, right, let's let Nicolas Mas pick up and just run into Steve Thompson, and he'll probably get nailed. And Lewis Deacon looks at this, coming back from an offside position, and just thinks, nah, I'm going to save Steve a job here, and just tackles him from an offside position, makes no impact whatsoever. And frankly, Steve Thompson would have nailed him, and he just gets penalised in the most easy penalty you'll ever give.
So I saw that, and I have it written down in my notes as Matt Stevens, because this was before I recognised that Lewis Deacon would ever play in a World Cup quarterfinal. And I just went, who else could that possibly be? Who had a similar haircut? Because it can't possibly be Lewis Deacon.
I did have to check who it was.
Yeah. Is this Matt Stevens pre-beak or post-beak?
It's the post-beak era. Yeah,
is this post-beak? Like, I couldn't remember. Yeah.
It's so pre-Eno, post-beak. So, he came back. And I think it was right after, actually. I think he'd come back like that summer. Was his those warm-ups for his first games back for England after...
Yeah.
Whatever he'd been doing in the break hadn't worked. The way he was getting shoved around. I mean, Nicolas Mas is a good scrummer, just to be fair.
Mm. Maybe we know exactly what he was doing.
I was going to say. typically not good for scrummaging. Or it might be. I don't know. I'm not one to say. Should we look at France's second try?
Sure. Yeah.
Before we move off that, just off the first try, Will. I think it is worth noting. It was a lovely, lovely move that put Clerc into the position he was in. The fact that five players that had a collective Keystone Cops meltdown shouldn't, you know, is by the by. But actually, it did. And France were doing that almost at will in the first half, running that sort of loop move. They just had more shape and more pattern.
Yeah.
And then England just came out again, one line miss pass, or throwing it into each other's faces, which seemed to keep happening as well. But yeah, go on. But it's just worth pointing out that they did have
just so much time as well. Like they just, England put no pressure on them. They just kind of let them run whatever they're going to do.
Because when Flood kicked that drop goal, everyone was running backwards away from the ball. Did you notice that?
They didn't.
It's like it was a bomb or something.
Reason to
like
watch it again.
Run away. Oh my God, it's covered in dog shit or something. It was very, very strange. Sorry, second try, Will.
That's okay. That's okay. I encourage these tangents. And frankly, the second try isn't nearly as funny as the first. I think it was probably funny for us when we watched it because it very much looked like Parra throws this really loopy ball over the top that I'm pretty sure anybody could have predicted it was going to Palisson on the wing. And they somehow don't shove him into touch before he's offloaded to Medar, who scores.
Yeah. When you see it from the kind of spider cammy angle, you realise how obvious the try was.
Yeah.
And there's then like four England players go in on Palisson and none of them notice Medar has just stood there waiting. Yeah. And any one of them could have just waited half a second and they would have stopped the try. But no, they just go, you know, nice sideburns. He can sneak through.
Was Ford the defensive coach of this tournament? Brian Smith was attack coach, wasn't he? And Ford was defence, I think. Bryce was assistant coach and ran the attack.
Mike Ford's definitely there because in the coach's box, he's wearing a formal shirt in the first half and the second half, he's wearing a T-shirt that looks like he bought it, you know, like outside a gig.
He probably stripped off and showed them his guns at half-time or something to try and encourage them to
motivate them.
To motivate them a little bit. But I have to say, the defensive... I mean, France ran some nice patterns, but it didn't take much to discombobulate the entire England tackle line, did it?
No.
And not just on that Clerk try. Everybody just seemed to all run towards the touchline, regardless of where the ball was going. And then, like your point, Will, then not bothering to push people into touch when they got there. It was the strangest gambit I've ever seen in terms of a defence, really.
You know that clip of the three professional footballers playing against the 100 Japanese school
children?
Yes. That's what England's defence is a bit like. That they all run to wherever the ball is, and then one of them stands near the goal, and they just hope for the best.
That is an excellent analogy. I like that.
Yeah.
So France go in 16-0 up at half time.
16-0.
Yeah.
And they looked good for it. And they looked fine for it as well. This wasn't a kind of, this had gone this way or that. No, that was absolutely right.
Like, Yashvili misses a kick, you know, 40 odd meters out, but still between the posts. And they missed the conversion on the Partizan try. They could have been further ahead and it wouldn't have felt wrong. That would have felt accurate to the half.
Yeah. I think France weren't incredible, don't get me wrong, but England were playing badly enough that France probably should have, well, could have scored a few more penalties or whatever.
Yeah.
At the time of us watching this at home, we probably found this hilarious. And I think by the time Medel went over it, there probably was a lot of laughter. And I was going to ask you about this, Lee. So in 2011, sort of where were you? How do you remember this World Cup? Do you remember watching the game or anything?
Vividly, because I was that weekend. I'm still friends with a lot of people I played rugby with at uni, and we decided to do that thing where we all get a big house in the Peak District.
Oh, okay.
And there was about 16 of us there, so friends, partners, kids, the lot, in the Peak, not far from your neck of the woods, I guess, is it? The Peak District, sort of. But I was at the Staffordshire side, the shit side, you know what I mean?
And then I wasn't going to say it, but
yeah. I'd never been to the Peak District before in my life, so I was very surprised at how... I don't know why I was surprised that a national park was beautiful, but I was surprised it was beautiful. I think because of its proximity to Stoke.
Yeah.
Nothing can be that beautiful if it's that close to Stoke, but I was wrong. It is. It's very beautiful. So anyway, so we're there. So long story short, I'd had about an hour's sleep because we'd got absolutely shit-faced on the Friday and we'd very excited about not seeing each other for ages. Mm. Up all night. I think I fell asleep on the couch for about 45 minutes for an hour. Then we were up because this was on early morning, as you said. So I'm sat there, hours sleep, absolutely hungover to shit. Most people there are English. It's all going this badly. The other thing I'm looking forward to is my mate worked for Coca-Cola, so I got discount tickets to Alton Towers.
Oh, wow.
So I'm thinking, this game's going like this. I've had an hour's sleep. I want to throw up and or die and or sleep for a week. I'm having to watch another half of this. And then after that, I've got to take the kids to Walton fucking Towers on this level of sleep and this level of hangover. So that's where I was at halftime. And to be honest, if I'd have probably said that to them in the dressing room at halftime, they might have booked their ideas up, quite frankly. Never mind actually, George Ford taking his top off and flexing. Mike Ford.
You would do marginally
George Ford
better
like
than
16-year-old son ran.
Yeah, take your top off and get flexing for him.
You're doing marginally better than Lewis Deacon then.
Yeah, I was going to say that's largely what Lewis Moody had to say. That was where he was.
Yeah, oh, but yeah, so it was, and my mate who, you know, some people with a hangover are really, really suffer.
Mm.
My mate just suffered, and he just kept sort of maniacally laughing every time England did something really terrible. So imagine it was just like a rolling maniacal laugh for him for most of this game.
He's still going from that drop goal.
Yeah, absolutely incredible stuff. Yeah. So and then Alton Towers for the rest of the day, which was, I think, probably my worst day out ever. My kids were 8 and 6 at the time. There were other kids there. We were having to drag them round. I ended up on the log flume. It was just the worst, which is a bath in Alton Towers. Have you seen that? It's not actually a log.
No.
It's a bath. They're all baths that you sit in.
Wow.
Horrific. Hmm. So I don't recommend it. So I'm glad, you know, I wish I was your age and at home like you were.
Did you make it to full time then?
Oh, I did make it to full time, but it was clearly, I think I remember knowing, because there's that sort of mid to late rally by England, isn't there, which we'll come on to.
Yeah.
But I remember knowing this is absolutely fucking doomed. And even if it isn't, I was starting to think maybe we'll get to the final again, despite being the worst team in the world, like we did in 2007. But I just knew, I thought actually it would be unseemly for us to go any further in this tournament. I mean, your point before about how awful we've been in the group stages. I mean, the Scotland game was like some kind of flash mob trying to describe malaise in dance. It was just absolutely minging, all of it. All of it was just utterly awful. And I kind of dreaded every weekend rolling around. And to the point at which my kids were Welsh and I was living in Wales at the time, I thought, I actually want England to get knocked out. So I can maybe just claim Wales for a couple of weeks. You know, it was that kind of, it was just horrendous. It really was horrendous. But yeah, but watching it again, it didn't seem as bad as I remember. But that doesn't mean that it was good. I want to emphasize that. It doesn't mean it was good either.
We should have sent you to Walton Towers after you watched it this time as well.
I should have relived the whole thing and gone to Walton Towers. I don't care. There is a lockdown. I've got research to do. Let me in.
We'll pretend to be your kids.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We should have done an Alton Towers retrospective podcast.
Yeah, that's true. We have that lined up.
Yeah.
I don't even like fairground rides myself. I don't watch horror films or go on fairground rides. I've got no interest in that kind of things that grown-ups are into, really. No.
Did you not? Because I went to, when I was in Canada a few years ago, Canada's Wonderland, which is their equivalent of Alton Towers. And I realised I must be old now because I just spent the whole day with a headache, and that's my only memory of it, was just getting really dizzy and headachey. And did having a hangover combined with that not feel like, and England in the World Cup and having to watch all of that, not feel like just the worst thing? Was that not, was your head not bleeding internally as a result?
It was, I just couldn't wait for the day to end so I could go to bed. I was living a nightmare anyway, so I wanted to go to sleep to have the sweet release of just black sleep. It was absolutely unbelievable. And like, there were massive queues in Old Town. I mean, why do people queue up for 3 hours to have the shit scared out of them? I don't understand. You wouldn't queue up for 3 hours to go in a car crash, would you? I don't understand why people do it.
It's that kind of... never mind. I mean, we could get into the philosophy of roller coasters.
Let's do it.
That's another podcast coming soon. That's the sort of thing Spotify would pay us for.
You'd hope so. If not kicking people's heads in, the philosophy of roller coasters.
That sounds like a Pink Floyd album.
That's in the, you know, period.
Yeah.
So the second half, I have far less written on the second half because both teams are broadly shite.
Yeah, me too.
England looked better in the second half, and I know why, because of what you just said. The pennies just dropped. Why did England look better? Because France had to come way down, way down and equalise it all. Yeah.
That and the 16-year-old George Ford coming in and stripping for them, doing a full Magic Mike routine, Magic Mike Ford routine in the changing room.
Can't do it now, Robbie. Can't do it now.
Had dwarf tossing and underage.
Dwarf tossing, underage flexing at half time. Incredible stuff.
Then jumping off a pier, you know, jumping off a boat into the river.
Do you think that's what inspired James Haskell's OnlyFans?
I think that point around the dwarf tossing, all that stuff, though, I mean, that's the other thing. Just the revolting stench that existed around this entire squad as well was. Mm. As well as the absolutely fetid performances, was just, it really was the worst of times.
Well, so you look at that squad, and broadly speaking, almost everyone is, whether in a non-pitch persona or a general off-pitch everything, a cunt. Apart from Johnny Wilkinson, who has played the worst rugby of his life, probably because he's surrounded by all of these Haskells, as we call it. In order to pass, you know, it means the same thing, but it means we can pass PG ratings.
I mean, Tom Palmer was largely unoffensive.
That's
Tom
true.
Croft
That's
had the
true.
Lions thing going for him. Most people liked him. Nick Easter was horrible. He was like a golf club bully.
Oh, yeah. And I think I mentioned this on another episode recently, but now as a podcast where he discusses his sex life with Kieran Brackett.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which is a horrendous.
I powerfully wish I could unknow that, what you've just said.
So do I listened to like 20 minutes of an episode and was just astonished by what I was hearing. It needs to be heard to be believed, and you don't want to believe it. No, I was very harsh on that England team. What I mean is people didn't like Chris Ashton, even though I do.
Yeah, sure. And it's amazing that even in this game, like, Ashton was like on the lower end of the dickishness scale in this England team.
Oh yeah,
so, but, I mean, Ashton largely played very well, to be honest.
Okay, well, he was at the right part of his good performance bell endery axis, as I coined it, because as he scored tries, he was then that had dropped down, and then the bell endery had increased.
Mm.
So actually, he was at the kind of high point of his just playing well, so people could put up with the other stuff. I also like the fact that he brought a bit of character, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't the usual shit.
Oh, I love Chris Ashton for all of it. I love the whole package of the way he played and the way he handled himself. I don't think it's who he is. I think he kind of, it spirals out when he's playing, you know, it's his kind of confidence in that. Whereas someone like Haskell,
you think it comes with enjoyment.
Yeah, I think so.
I think he's just a bit daft.
Yeah,
and I mean, and I don't mean thick. I mean, he's just a bit daft.
Yeah, he
likes doing daft things.
Yeah,
it's part of who he is, and I think that's why I could never truly understand why people properly got quite viscerally angry about him.
Yeah,
but no, not at all. But the thing about this whole England team, and it's the same in the second half, is they seem kind of like, and I think it says something about the way they were managed. I think because they seem sort of paralysed by their own sort of diffidence, and it's like you don't really believe you can do this, do you? Any of you, apart from maybe Chris Ashton and maybe Ben Foden.
Yeah.
Because Foden was quite new into it at this point. And he, you know, we'll come on to later on. He did a nice try, didn't he? But
he's. We'll talk about that now if you want.
Let's do that then, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of feels like England got into the 22 by accident.
Well, it's Young's being really sharp.
Yeah.
Because he really picks
quick
up
tap,
on the
wasn't
second
it? Yeah. Yeah. And it kind of felt like nobody else really was keeping up with him that whole way. And it kind of forces Youngs to panic a little bit. But he was really composed at this point in his career, and I suppose still is, you know. And as I said, it does slightly feel like by accident they've gone through some really, really good phases. And the phase that Ben Foden scores doesn't feel like that was the one, you know?
Yeah.
But it's a lovely step by Foden, and he takes the try really, really well.
I mean, I must point out, I mean, the number of New Zealander names and Maori names I must have mangled in my time. I have to forgive Maori TV for saying Foden, because Christ knows I've probably said Rondi Soilo.
If they can say Totoro or Toure Arangi, however it's pronounced, I'm
exactly
a bit of a hypocrite.
I hold my hands up, yeah.
It doesn't feel like that's going to be the moment they score. And you don't see anything in that set of phases that you think, oh, they're going to score from this. You know, if it was inevitable. And then just France's defence is, it's less like the Japanese school children and more like some kids just walking home from the park, because they're just sort of like in a gang, kind of like hobbling about. It's not a line per se. And so Foden kind of has to step them as a group as they're all heading towards their bikes, and then just happens to cross. It feels almost accidental. You know, it feels like rugby breaking out in the middle of something else happening.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose it was not long after that they kind of think, well, if that's how we break down what's allegedly going to become a World Cup semi-final level defence, then we know what to do. Give it to Toby Flood, get him to run perfectly straight. And that happened.
Other thing about the Ben Foden try is this is his third try over this sort of period. And it is the first one where he doesn't do the baby in the crib celebration.
Oh, of course.
Presumably because one of the other women he had pregnant saw it on TV and found out.
Yeah, that's entirely valid.
How old was Flood at this point?
Flood?
I want to say 22.
Toby Flood.
I reckon he'd been a bit more than 22. I think he's about, what,
he's
51 now?
He's
35
now.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, so about 24, 25 then. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
Wow, was he only... Yeah. Yeah, he was only 25.
Right.
Wow, was he...
And he was today's man, of course, because Gavin established. Unlike Johnny, yesterday's man, wandering around smoking a pipe. You know, what's he going to achieve? What do we think about Johnny Wilkinson's performance in this game? Actually, I mean, obviously you're grading on a curve here, but what do you think about? I think he was taking far too many pelters on Maori TV than he deserved. He really seems to be trying to get something going.
Yeah,
I think you dropped a component that could work on its own into a team where it didn't work at all.
Yeah.
And I think we'd seen this England team, as you said, they won the Six Nations, playing a very, very different brand of rugby to what they were doing when they put Wilkinson in at 10. And in those pool games against Romania and Georgia, where they had Flood at 10, they played like they did in the Six Nations, and it slotted far better. And I think we ended up this England team caught in two minds of Wilkinson wanting to play the 2003 game plan, and then the others wanting to play the attack-minded stuff they'd done in the Six Nations. And they kind of fell into this just nothingness.
Yeah. He had a few moments, Wilkinson. Yeah, he put in a couple of great kicks, a couple of good passes, but there was that kick he put in out on the full, which was quite disappointing. You know, there was, as I say, there was the pass into touch. There was a really good offload, actually, that it did to Nick Easter that nearly set up an opportunity for the Mark Cueto.
I got excited about that until I realised Nick Easter was carrying the ball. And I calmed down very quickly.
So there was a great point when Ben Youngs picks up the ball slightly confused, but does brilliantly out of it, draws in a couple of French players, sends Toby Flood for a bit of a gap. And then Toby Flood just kind of gets confused about, oh, what do I do when you make a line break? And just kind of starts carrying the ball in one hand like he's Leone Nakarawa, and just kind of flings it over his shoulder to Morgan Parra.
Yes.
Who then boots it back downfield, and England end up back in their own 22.
You know, Parra spent all week working on his kind of, you know, Buckinghamshire accent in order to call for that if the moment came.
A great moment around then as well was England have a line out in their own 22. And It's a really unconventional strategy, but I guess it's effective. But Dylan Hartley, just first thing he does when he gets on the field is he just overthrows the ball to Maxime Mermoz, who is randomly stood about 20 metres offside and obviously even get the penalty for it. And you think if he doesn't get away with that, he's conceding 5 points. But I think that's a positive level of shithousery from Dylan Hartley.
Yeah, I mean, I think there could have been a point of order from Mermoz to say that obviously nobody should throw the ball like that into a lineup, so I can't be held accountable for the fact that I'm stood here because it should never come to me. What the hell is he thinking? But yeah, he caught him out, one and two. The England bench is a funny one, actually, because they emptied it pretty much from minute 50 onwards, didn't they?
Yeah.
Fairly quickly until 65, but a lot of it happened quite quickly. That seemed to make things a bit better for me.
Yeah.
But again, I'm talking that there's better and there's better, isn't there?
Sure.
It seems to get a little bit more competitive.
Yeah.
They make one change in particular. I think it's the first substitute they bring on, they bring on a replacement second row. And the French commentators refer to the player coming on as Courtney Love.
No.
Which I wish I'd recorded, but alas.
Doesn't he look thin, by the way? Courtney Laws, man.
Tiny,
he looks like
he?
Really undersized, doesn't he?
Looks like a different guy.
Completely. Yeah. But obviously international level forward at the time.
Of course.
But yeah.
And he's still got
like
the world's
kind of
longest arms.
Yeah. I can see that. There's like a weird whiff of Gael Ficou about him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Shape-wise, yeah.
To say there isn't now at all. But
no, he's like really big now. But obviously I think that's... We're 10 years on in the conditioning world, aren't we?
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, he's been to the gym once or twice since then, I suppose.
Yeah.
I love that French pack, though. Speaking of packs, that French pack is lovely. William Servat looks younger now than he did then.
Yeah.
And he's running water bottles on. He somehow looks younger now than he did then.
He's one of those players who I think just not being smashed around the gills every week's done him good.
Yes. And I had a very long-standing, deep love affair for Julien Bonheur. I absolutely loved him.
Brilliant.
Oh,
so
what
good.
A player, yeah.
And he had an unbelievable group stage. He was like one of their only good players against Tonga when they lost. And he's just one of those really underrated players that whenever England did anything threatening, he would slow down the ball and organise. And that, obviously that whole back three with Doutatoire and Arnaudicky was immense. And when you see them bring on Louis Picamoy, you think, oh, it doesn't get any easier, does it?
It's one of those things that used to be a cliche, but as a seven, always on the shoulder, always there. No matter what happened, he was there to either clear out the next ruck really fast or take an offload. He's just, but he seemed to be everywhere.
Yeah.
I think he ended up playing lock under Saint-André, didn't he?
He did. Yes.
Jesus Christ almighty. Honest to God.
How to waste a player.
My word. Yeah.
And like, this is after that back row had retired. So like, it's not like it was to accommodate for Doutatoire or Arnaudicky. It was, no, we're going to put the maybe the best ball carrying number 8 in the world at the time. We'll just put him in the second row.
Who did play?
It would have been
in the back row.
Le Cafio or somebody like that, wouldn't it?
So Julien Bonheur and Arnaudicky both. Bonheur and Arnaudicky's last game was the same game.
Right.
It was a 69 loss to Wales. In 2012. Oh, the Dan Lydiard Grand Slam game. Last time either of them played for France.
Right.
This is going to be too much of a rabbit hole. I thought we could get there very quickly.
No. Okay. Well, I can quickly divert to... I mentioned Courtney Laws going to the gym a minute ago, and I think the best segue is to send it over to James Haskell coming onto the pitch. So... James Haskell runs onto the pitch, you know, looking massive and looking banterific and whatever it is that he looks. And the commentators on Maori TV start talking about, oh, here he is, here's the big man, you know, he's going to make a real difference. He's going to start battering them about, you know, he's a big man. And then first clear out, he is completely ineffective. I do wonder if he was saying to them, you know, oh, I'm used to clearing out men who are much bigger and stronger than you, you know, but I'll deal with this in that kind of banterific way that he does.
He has that, you know, obviously, you know, I'm a big fan, but
yes,
he's
only fan.
He has that Pierre Spies thing going on, Haskell.
Mm.
He passes the eye test to such an extent that people lose critical faculty in analysing what he actually does.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Nobody actually goes, yeah, but he's just at best all right, isn't he? And because he is so massive and committed and fit and all that stuff. You know, the kind of stuff that they use to talk about, I don't know, a fucking cement mixer or something. becomes something that's so incredible. They're doing it about Tom Curry now, aren't they? Who's always in your eye line. What, like my dado rail? Oh, I mean, I don't. What is it you're trying to say? You know, it's kind of. They're not bad players, right? I mean, I've got other issues with Haskell, but of course, he was a perfectly competent professional forward who deserved international caps, and he had a very good 2016, didn't he? Mm. But the expectation of it. Because he was strong and a bit quick, I suppose. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
I do think he had that brand thing. He wasn't stupid. Exactly. He knew how to sell himself and he passed the eye test.
Yeah. And so he became a big enough name that the casual observer really latched onto him. And as you say, there's this weird thing of him being so good against Australia in that 2016, that year, that it kind of almost makes it difficult to make broad sweeping statements about his career because he genuinely had one really good year in the middle of it.
He did.
And then tailed off a bit, and had issues beforehand. But it complicates things. But my now main memory of James Haskell as a player, ironically, or fitting, I suppose, no, is not something he did on the pitch. I remember talking, I don't think I've told this story in here before, but I remember talking to someone like a week or two after the World Cup final in 2019 at a poetry night, because, you know, those are the circles I mix in Birmingham. And someone...
What was the banter level like there?
You couldn't believe it.
Did James Haskell turn up to this poetry night?
James Haskell turned up and read conversations he'd had with women on Instagram. Yeah.
It was beat banter. Hashtag beat banter.
That sounds like something very different.
I put my dog on a lead when I want to. You don't tell me.
Are you free for the next time we do? Next time that happens, any chance?
Do him over Zoom. I'm there.
Yeah. Oh, come along. I was talking to someone there who asked, you know, like, oh, how had the, you know, World Cup final gone or whatever, knowing, you know, I'd been in Japan and so on. And I said, oh, England lost the final in South Africa. And their first comment was, South Africa, you know, that's a bit embarrassing. It would have been okay if it was someone like Canada or like Ireland, which I enjoyed as a throwaway comment.
What I love about that is that no matter what team it is, whether it's South Africa or whoever, they're saying, oh, no, a couple people lost that game to the team who won the World Cup.
Yeah, like that's the embarrassing bit. But then he asked me, was James Haskell playing? And I said, no. And he said, well, of course they lost then. And that was, I think, the level of rugby understanding for a lot of people. You know, they had like three players whose names they knew, and Haskell was one of them. And he just got kind of caught up in this whole thing through his brand stuff.
I mean, it's, you know, a part of me admires him.
Mm.
It's a part of me that I despise. But it's a part of I am it's still but still it's a part of me, therefore I have to accept it. You know, you have to, hats off to him, he did have a strategy he worked hard, he clearly worked hard physically and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, but it all comes back to Will's point, the commentary, everybody drinks the Kool-Aid on it, don't they? His physical specimens come in to rock your world, and then he falls off the first rope, you know.
Yeah, he's very large and possesses the bants, I believe is the correct rugby-specific term for it, a coaching term. Also, here's the thing. I've not thought about this before now. How do you think Martin Johnson responded to all of that bants in the camp?
Oh, I bet he just didn't listen. I bet he just got on with it. Or he, you know, he's the sort of, he would say in one of those interviews of like, yes, James is obviously a very funny man, and then would move along.
I mean, you've probably covered the ridiculousness of Johnson in other episodes. I don't want to, not so much him himself, the appointment of Johnson. And given his lack of experience, I don't know how he was dealing with, because he used to be the captain, didn't he? And he played with world-class players at the time. So a lot of him, when he was a captain, he'd just say, don't worry about it, lads, just keep doing what you're doing and I'm going to win this. And if that was his plan, that's why we got what we got in many ways.
Yeah. Telling Mark Cueto and Toby Flood that.
Yeah, keep doing what you're doing. Just keep walking it up, Toby. Straight into him and I'll add an order key. That'll do. But I get this like Brian Clough feeling, not in the fact that he's a genius, but the fact that Clough would sometimes just walk around the training ground with his Labrador. and then walk off without saying anything. I've got a bit of a feeling about that with Johnson. Do you know what I mean? That actually he was like, he appointed this staff and I'd just come up and say the odd thing, but he probably wasn't close enough to listen to all the nonsense that the hashtag banter that would have been coming out, I don't think.
It's like they appointed the Brian Clough statue in Nottingham as their manager.
They wanted the kind of sort of talisman figure without any of the talent.
Yeah.
The actual leading of people, you know. Which sounds terrible because Johnson obviously did a brilliant job as a captain, but they're very different jobs, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was on the episode we did with Nick Heath where he talked a lot about, you know, the rumours he was demoted during the World Cup and they gave him less responsibility and they stopped putting the other coaches in charge and so on. And he was more there as a motivator and team manager rather than, you know, actually being the head coach as he was paid for and appointed as.
Became a mascot.
Yeah, exactly. He was Ruckley. He was the Ruckley of his day.
Ruckley in double pleats trousers.
Now there's a fan fiction I want to write.
Hang on. Are we suggesting that the England coach in this World Cup was not their mercurial World Cup winning captain, but perhaps two boys in a suit
on top of each other, on each other's shoulders, doing a dog bark?
Yeah, one of those children was George Ford.
They just brought that was why they were so terrible in the second half. They'd just seen their head coach split himself in half like a worm and then start flexing topless as an underage boy.
I'm just imagining the team talk when they huddle them together and Lewis Moody just kind of goes, well, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. He just unzips himself down the middle, like straight across his nose.
Lads, I don't know what we can do about this.
I often see there's like rugby players that are a bit like Boxer the Horse from Animal Farm. You know, his solution to everything was, I will work harder.
Yes.
That's Lewis Moody's captain. I'll just work harder. I'll just run after more kickoffs and I'll get more blood on my face and just, you know, that'll sort it all out, won't it, lads? You believe me, don't you, lads? You believe me, don't you? This is no, Lewis.
No, but we've just found out that Martin Johnson was actually, this was how Owen Farrell and George Ford formed their partnership.
I was just about to say that when they said they'd been through a lot together.
Yeah.
You think this is what it really is, but they could never say. It's because they had to be Ruckley and somehow to be Martin Johnson dressed up in double pleat trousers.
A pantomime workhorse.
Amazing.
There you are.
There's liking the thought that somebody just passed George Ford and Owen Farrell an NDA and just saying, no one can ever know about this.
By the X Factor, nobody's allowed to say what actually happens in the process.
Except Jedward. We need Jedward to immediately do an exclusive scoop on Owen Fowler and George Ford stacking on each other's shoulders and pretending to be Martin Johnson.
That bloke who won the first X Factor then was erased from history, like somebody on the Kremlin wall was Steve Bernstein, was it? He kept coming out.
You're asking the wrong people.
I know, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I do know, but I can't possibly comment.
Yeah. Sorry, I've lost track of what we're saying that... Well, I've lost track anyway. I've lost track of what we're... So would George Ford, are we saying George Ford and Owen Farrell as children were Ruckley or were actually Martin Johnson in this tournament?
I think we're
somewhere in the middle of the two.
I think they're the same person.
I mean, this Ruckley fiction writes itself, doesn't it? We've done this before, but this really does write itself.
It's so easy. It's a great sequel to the Deacon Marnie fan fiction.
that people have been sending in.
Do we have anything else as we move on to Man of the Match and Dick of the Day?
I mean, we've got a drop goal and a try to cover.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Francois Trandouk scores a drop goal.
England did competent things.
Yeah, yeah. Francois Trandouk dropped into the pocket and I weirdly didn't expect it. And I just kind of thought, oh, fair play. He struck that quite well.
Yeah. It's a proper moment of just having a competent fly half working.
Yeah.
And again, you'd have thought France could take the lesson from that. Isn't what a great impact sub. But we should have a fly half.
Yeah.
I mean, Ben Young's learned a lot from that. It's amazing the impact of actually passing to your outside half can have on a game, isn't it? Particularly when you're... And also being actually within drop goal range and not doing it half-cocked from about 50 metres out, yeah.
It's almost like it's easy to score a drop goal if you're closer to the posts, isn't it?
And between them as well, yeah.
Yeah.
It really actually mirrored quite a bit of Johnny Wilkinson's drop goal against France in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
At the same stage, actually. Was it the semi that game? Can't remember. Anyway, that kind of quite quick snap from quite close in.
Mm.
It was, yeah, so maybe Tranduk knew that. And he was like, I'm going to show you bastards. I'll take this game away from you in a way none of you remember, but I will get take delicious comfort from it. I don't think he thinks that deeply, to be fair.
Of course, the next thing, the competent thing that you're on about there, Robbie, that England do is...
Yeah, competent's a bit of a strong word.
Well, they go via Matt Banahan, who makes a break, and he does decently until somebody suggests that he might need to pass.
So that Banahan thing, and this happens again with Manu Tuilagi in the first half, right? Have you realised the impact defence coaches have had? Because there's a points in which either Manu Tuilagi or Matt Banahan have a bit of a run-up, and they just go straight. It causes so much havoc that no one can even work out how you might approach tackling them.
I love that one with Tuilagi.
Not backwards. Yeah.
Tuilagi runs in a perfectly straight line and everyone steps out of his way.
But it's just, the game has changed so much in 10 years, defensively. Yeah. You know, like nowadays you'd be caught well behind the game and I've never seen coming. Yeah.
Easily. Whereas this time it's just two French prop just go, nah, don't fancy it. It's not even quite your man. It's just like, just let him through, lads.
Yeah.
Show me his pass.
Maori TV, when Banahan came on, by the way, he lined up in the sort of 12 channel off a scrum, I think.
Yeah.
And that was when they were literally sort of saying, oh my God, look how big he, look at him. He's 14 feet taller than anybody else in the entire world. And there he is, ready for the ball. It was, it's like, you are Maori lads, aren't you? I'm sure you've seen a few tall lads in midfield before, surely. It's because he's dressed in white. Is that what makes him stand out more or something? No idea.
Not sure.
Just like on the Tuilagi thing, I wonder if at this point, you know, after they got knocked out, he was wishing that he instead had played for the team, you know, the two teams he was eligible for, that wasn't behind the scenes a corrupt inside organisation with no forward planning or, you know, like financial stability. You know, because he had a choice of Samoa or England and he really picked the one that wasn't there.
Nice.
I botched that joke, but I could see it very clearly in my mind.
I like it.
Like anything Manu Tuilagi had to do involving passing.
So Matt Banahan makes his break.
Yes.
He's pulled to floor by Maxime Médard. And then for some reason, as England ruck over, they get a quite quick ball. And then Richard Wigglesworth just decides to wait until the entire French team are all back on side before he plays it, which, you know, is an interesting hashtag fair play strategy.
Rugby values.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Look at this guy. It was great sportsmanship for him to make sure that his other team were ready.
Yes, I mean, that's a gentleman's way. You don't attack when they're disorganised. That's a cat's approach.
Rugby's different, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we see it all the time in tennis where the opposition guy has turned his back and people just go for an ace, lads, you know, and just twat it into the other half of the court. But Richard Wigglesworth, he would never.
And while he was waiting for that defence to realign, he was brushing up, picking up the cones.
Sweeping the sheds.
Shaking the opposition coach's hand.
Lifting people up off the floor, afterwards. That was the latest one. You see that one last week?
No.
After a tackle, somebody obviously gives somebody a hand up and like, see, this is why rugby's different. So, you know, if that was football, he literally would have smeared shit in his face while he was sat down there when he was on the floor. But no.
Bent over and shat in his
face.
Yeah,
literally. He probably dropped his kecks. Batman really Hans still carrying the ball, isn't he? No, Richard Wigglesworth.
Wigglesworth's there. We're getting through this. We're moving at what you could describe as Wigglesworth pace.
Yes, yeah. So then Toby Flood gets the ball and he thinks, you know what? I'm going to be creative here, lads. We've got potentially a World Cup semi-final worthy defence in front of me, as I touched upon before. So I'm going to do something other than just run directly into them all. I'm going to put a grubber kick in. And you know what? Fair play. Brilliant kick.
I mean, you say that, it takes 3 deflections.
Oh, yeah, no. He could have got from A to B a lot easier. He could have passed the ball and Cueto would have walked in. I get that. But given he wanted to take the most complicated route from A to B, it was a great kick in the circumstances.
It was a kick, yeah. Like,
it landed perfectly between the French players. And, I mean, as I say, would have been much easier if he just maybe ran there or passed it or something. Or he did basically anything else.
Yeah.
But at least he didn't kick it into the stands, you know. And Simon Shaw kind of flies halfway across the pitch to kind of save the ball from going into the in-goal area. And Mark Cueto just rolls around for a little bit. And there's a lot of debate about what on earth happened after that.
They spend a long time. It's the only TMO, so I don't know if, you know, Steve just wanted a chat. But it took a long time to find the right angle. Yeah.
They showed one angle which didn't show where the ball was four times before they found the one from the other side. It was incredible.
My favourite thing is, after the try is given, the camera cuts over to Mark Waito, who throws his arms up in the air like he's fuming that this is the big World Cup knockout TMO decision that's gone his way.
Yeah. Yes.
And she's like, all right, we're going to give this one, are we, lads?
It looked like the way he was moving, it looked like he was doing this. You won't get this probably. He looks like he was doing the oops upside your head dance. Anybody who's old is doing that. He's just sit on the floor and that's what he's trying to do with the ball. But it was so obviously down. Steve was just on vibes again, wasn't he? He was just like, ah, well.
What if everyone hates England? Can I allow the try then?
Yeah, exactly. Can I find a way of getting away with not giving this? No, don't find the right angle. It's fine. Take as long as you need. That happened in 2007 as well. It took him about 20 minutes to find the actual angle to see Cueto's foot in touch.
Yeah. People are still searching now, I believe.
Speaking of Wigglesworth, you know, trivia question, you might know this. Who was the third scrum, for our listeners out there, who was the third scrum half for England in this squad?
Joe Simpson.
Joe Simpson. You could have given me 500 goes at that and I wouldn't have got it.
You know, his only cap against Georgia in this World Cup.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
One of those just mad World Cup moments that, you know, it's the kind of thing when ITV do their look backs on great rugby World Cup moments the night before the next tournament, whoo, will Joe Simpson's one wonder cap against Georgia get an outing again?
After the Cueto try goes over and Flood horribly misses the conversion and everything, blah, 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 we'll skip over that. The commentators suddenly go, oh, well, it's now a 7-point game. And it's we're heavily towards the last play of the game. And they start talking about penalty shootouts as a possibility, as though this England team aren't really shit and also in their own 22. Like, as if England are actually going to go the length and score.
Yeah, and it's, yeah. And when he misses the kick, they kind of go, oh, well, you know, that could be a problem for England now. So, yeah, that's it. That's the problem for England, is the fact that he's just missed that kick.
Not the past 79 minutes.
Yeah, total bunch of bloody idiots the last 79 minutes, yeah.
And then they decide to resolve this. You know, because sometimes you do have it, right, where a team has this valiant effort. It's the last minute of the game. You think, right, they're going to give this a good go. But instead, Manu Tuilagi just runs into touch.
It's incredible, isn't it, that Tuilagi's so... I don't think he's worked out what passing is. I don't think he's worked out it's a thing that happens in both directions yet.
Yeah.
And considering the level of chaos he could cause, I sort of get it watching it back in a way I just, you know, I think in a very 16-year-old Welsh fan way, is to go, he's not that good, he can't pass.
Yeah.
Actually watching it back, like, oh, and he was quite good.
Yeah, and maybe he just didn't trust Mark Waito.
If he could occasionally let the ball go from his hands, in a knock-on kind of way, then, you know what? Could have been quite effective, maybe.
Which, I mean, Mar Nonu didn't learn how to pass, didn't know that passing was a thing. He was about 32.
Yeah.
Literally. And he had about 50 caps by then. So all of a sudden at 32, he did this thing. Like, you know, like a baby first realises that's their hands. And they kind of look at it. He must have had that kind of moment, Mar. He's gone, fucking hell, I can... Whoa, that's what this thing does.
He developed object permanence somewhere around 24. Like the ball remains existing when it's not in my hands.
But again, I've always, I've got a bit of a thing that I don't think Manu Tuilagi is as good as people say is. And I think a lot of it's born in these games. He has a couple of good runs.
Yeah.
And then every time he touches the ball, there's this like, and something amazing's going to happen. And actually, no, he just runs into the line and gets tackled, doesn't pass, or like you said, well, legs it into touch for inexplicable reasons. So, and I think there's a bit of that, you know, of course he's a destructive physical presence and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think he really solved a lot of that.
Not enough, anyway,
after 10 years.
Yeah, he's better now. But as you say, it's 10 years. Like you should have. Martin only became a genuine distributory 12.
Like, so he could play fly off.
Yeah.
I mean, and like, that's at a point.
Yeah. And, you know, you watching him in MLR and how much fun that was just because of he was seeing things the other players wouldn't have if they'd given a freeze frame and like a graph, you know, and like all the possible options available.
And a six-dimensional globe of the pitch.
Exactly. Know? Whereas Nonu was getting them straight off the bat, you know, just by the slightest glance.
Yeah, the space is there, lads. Have we tried over there?
I mean, there's no one on that wing.
Yeah.
But yeah. Sorry, no, were you about to...
Last thing I have to say on this match before we go to our concluding segments is that the very last play, so England give away a penalty in classic, like how else would they bow out of this World Cup other than giving away a stupid, dumb penalty? And then, you know, Doucetois does the thing of like taking his time to make sure they're in the last minute. So if they kick for goal, they've got enough time that even if they miss, they've still won. And I'm pretty sure the camera goes to Toby Flood. I'm pretty sure he starts pointing his forwards, saying for them to like start doing like line out jumps, Danny Grucock style, like to try and block the kick from going over. Like that wasn't outlawed in 2002.
I don't understand why Parrott even went for the posts. I don't mean as in, I mean the direction he kicked the ball. I mean, like, why would you risk it? Like you catching it slightly wrong and it not drifting dead. Just kick it straight dead. You know what I mean? Like, in parallel with the touchline. Just
look like you're trying.
I shan't that one, ref. Sorry.
Yeah.
And, like, it's Morgan Parry. You know, he's got form.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Right. Shall we move on to our man of the match, dick of the day, bring this thing home?
Sure.
Begin with dick of the day. Let's start with dick of the day. It feels like a day to start on dick of the day.
Do you want to start, Robbie?
Sure. Okay. I mean, there's one contender. I don't know if you watched the French anthem, Fruit, but as it's going on, you know that classic thing, like when you're singing along to a song on the radio and you get the wrong verse out at the wrong time?
Yeah.
And you then have to kind of fumble and go, ah, da, 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 and then just stop still for a moment until you can join back in when it gets onto the chorus. Maxime Mamoz does that during the national anthem. he starts singing the wrong verse or something, realizes what he's doing, stops singing for a bit.
Hang on, this isn't the anthem. Like, this is Moves Like Jagger.
It's 2015, same 2011, same deal. And then continues later on. That is a contender, you know, if you're just getting your national anthem wrong and having to stop and do like a reverse spin to prevent it. But I mean, almost anything England do could be a contender. Also, like Mike Catt for changing into a shirt that seems to have a Dalek on it at half time. Like, threw me a bit. But it's a positive dick of the day because I want to celebrate Chris Ashton tackling Ben Foden.
Yes. And
it's a moment I enjoyed so much, I have to commemorate it with an award.
Fair enough.
So Chris Ashton is my dick of the day.
I think you're objectively correct. However, I have to give it to Mark Waito for running backwards and bit like any defence coach would love that, wouldn't they? You know? And I think France didn't have to, you know, he saved the French a job, you know, rugby values, you know, made the job a little bit easier. So Mark Waito's my dick of the day.
And Lee?
Yeah, I think Dylan Hartley for coming on and making the line out demonstrably worse most of the time.
Yeah.
Entirely valid.
Hard to argue with. Man of the match, shall I? I mean,
go on.
Again, you're just looking through the French team sheet. Vincent Clair is really, really good. I then think, though, the French back row is really the standout thing. And tempted by Doucetois, tempted by Bonnet, but Emmanuel Arnaudicki, for me, who we haven't mentioned, I think, once, maybe in passing, is phenomenal and is everywhere and is hitting everything and is carrying so hard and makes a couple of breaks and is just so annoying. So, yeah, the hairy donkey. Also, has a fight with Lewis Deacon at one point off the ball. Yeah, he just like pulls him out of a maul and the two of them lie on the floor. And Lewis Deacon, it could be a like dick of the day contender moment, tries to swing to hit him, off him, and just misses him completely several times. And that is some man of the match shit for me.
Yeah.
Is that the bit where they're rolling around on the floor, play continues, and Steve Walsh turns around and points at them?
Yes.
And then just carries on, then goes back to what? It's not like he kind of goes, yeah, you go on yourselves, lads. I'll be over here. Sort of thing is
proper like school mastery moment.
Yeah,
for me, I mean, Aurélien Rougerie was great. I thought. I think he attacked really well and made some big hits. I think, as you said, Doucetois, I think was everywhere. But for me, Maxime Mermoz. Massive, like, creative dickhead energy. You know, he was always, like, getting in the way of whenever England tried to do anything. Mermoz would just really creepily pop up and intercept the ball or whatever. And I think he had a few decent attacks where maybe he could have passed, but he looked good regardless. So Mermoz is man of the match for me.
I've got a lot of time for Lionel Nally, simply mainly due to the size of his head. just that in itself is at least the first six of his nine out of ten score. But yeah, just again, I think him and Pape really just show what having proper international class second rows does for a team in some ways. But I'll come back to your first one, Robbie. Actually, I kind of forgotten what magic Vincent Clair could be.
Mm-hmm.
Just because every time he got the ball, really, one, of course, he caused five people to run into each other, which is brilliant, and tackle each other. But actually, every time he got the ball, he did something. Mm. And, it's easy. I shouldn't forget, because he's one of the all-time top scorers of European rugby and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah. So he's kind of my man of the match on Nally, yeah. But the back row just goes without saying. Yeah, Deuce towards excellence was just accepted. It almost stopped being commented on by the end. It was just so typical of him, really.
Mm. He just pops up and does something great every sort of other minute, if not more frequently than that.
Yeah,
there's something stand out every other minute. To the point.
Did you notice how much lower the tackle count was?
Yeah,
generally, is it? It didn't look like there were less tackles in the game. I'm assuming they've changed the way they count.
But I think teams now deliberately go through phases in a way you were kind of looking 10 years ago to break a team down first phase. Or second phase. Every time.
Within the phase you have, you'd think about doing it rather than now. You know, tens will often go, right, next phase, I'll call for the ball. Trying to anticipate how the defence will respond to the number eight carrying it in. Like, attack coaches are so smart to this kind of thing. And that wasn't really something people thought about 10 years ago, was it?
Both teams made 109 tackles, which is a neat stat.
Mm. It's not many, though, is it?
No.
You'd be looking at least, 30% more than that on average?
Yeah.
If you were to look at, I have the stats for the England women's game from this.
Okay.
Might be an unfair comparison because they were flying into each other in that game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 183 to 125. So yeah, dramatically higher.
That's a massive difference.
And obviously this isn't, they'll be even higher in the men's game.
Yeah.
I just happen to have that one open at the minute.
Yeah.
Yeah,
as you say, that was a notably physical game, but regardless, that is a marked difference.
It's a good point about phasing, though. You're right, actually, now I think about it.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, 11, 13 phases periods now are fairly typical, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Teams set up for it, teams anticipate they're going to be playing, an extra how many other phases.
It's amazing. There used to be, as obviously watching back a lot of all these games, they used to have a thing on the little stat sheet at the end of the game saying, these are the amount of times that a team has 7+ phases, which is basically on the assumption that they'll be knackered after 7 phases. Mm. Whereas now, as you say, 13, 14 phases is fairly standard for an attacking set.
Yeah. So the England-France game from the Six Nations was 129 to 172 tackles.
Right, so largely the same as the women's game.
Yeah. But still a huge increase there.
Yeah.
One team was making 70-odd more tackles, the other one still 20 more.
Right, wow. That's a very telling stat.
It didn't feel like that watching it, though, was interesting. Mm. It's only when you saw the stats, you got that slow. But then, anyway, sorry, this is a rabbit hole, I'll stop.
That's okay.
Already. Yeah, we covered Dick the Daily Man of the Match, didn't we?
We did.
That's all. That's grand. That's wonderful. Okay. Well, Lee, thank you very much for joining us.
Got a lot of stuff out of my system, I'm not going to lie.
how are you feeling now?
For that opportunity,
How has it helped?
It has helped. I think I will, I'll sleep more soundly tonight than I have done in the last decade for having got this out. So thank you very much.
As an alternative to the Patreon thing, we are considering offering this service to England fans on the NHS. bit of funding. I happen to be Matt Hancock's cousin, so they're going to offer me a contract doing this, which is grand. There's a bit of satire for you. No, Lee, where can people find you on Twitter, the podcast, etc. if they heard this and want, I want more of that.
I'm at Blood and Mud on Twitter, or I am lee@bloodandmud.com if you want to do a long form contact. Or obviously with the Blood and Mud podcast, we're on Acast and all that stuff, and patreon.com/bloodandmud if you want to come and give a bit of support.
Mm.
Thank you, Lee. I've obviously listened to your podcast for a while as well, so it's great to have you on. I'm pretty sure that everybody who listens to this, we are the second favourite podcast to you, so they probably do all know who you are, but yeah, that's fine. I'm happy with that. But no, cheers for coming on. You know, massively enjoy your work.
Yours as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you, Will, or whoever you are. And thank you to everyone for listening. Please join us next time when we will move on to a game that, you know, the last two have been, you know, kind of talking points, controversy, the lot. The next one should be a pretty quiet one. It's Australia 11, South Africa 9.
I can only imagine that would be completely straightforward, no refereeing decisions to talk about. And, you know, we have semi-finals after that, so I'm sure there'll be no refereeing decisions to discuss from them either. Yeah, I think it's plain sailing from here on out.
Really, really straightforward one. I also flipped the scoreline round because I realised I was about to read it as 9-11. And that feels almost... I'm not going to finish that sentence, but I am going to finish this podcast. So, yeah, thank you very much for listening. Please join us to try and... I normally have a policy of not talking about referees, but I don't know if I'm going to manage that next time. Right, well, we'll see you then. Thank you very much. Good night.
Goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.